All right, today is, what is today? Today is the 28th of November, 2011. This is the third interview with Jill Hopke. We're here in the conference room in Steenbach Library on the campus of UW-Madison. I'm Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we are doing this interview for our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project. All right, Jill, thanks for coming. My first question is, we've talked a lot about chronology in our last interview, some of the key events and when they happened. And I know when we left off and turned off the recorder that one of the sort of last chronological events that you wanted to talk about, at least in terms of a specific event that happened on a specific day, was the Senate vote. So I think we'll start with that.
Sure. That was one of the more, there were a lot of memorable moments during the Capitol protests. Something was always happening and the days were very long. But the entire time until that day, I thought we would win. And by win, I mean I thought that we would stop the budget repair bill, which is now known as Wisconsin Act 10, from passing. I was perhaps a little overly idealistic, but maybe in a sense I had to believe that in order to be able to continue and work so hard and put in so many hours. But I really did think that we would defeat it, that with such a mass outpouring of public opposition, both about the content of the bill, but also about the process, and it was kind of an affront to democracy. It really was an attack on the democratic system, and that by making our voices heard, I thought that we would be able to stop the bill. And so that day, which was March 10th, the day that the Republicans voted on the bill, it shattered my faith in democratic process in many ways. That was a day that we knew something would happen. And I think that we need to remember that there was a context of in the weeks, in the nearly a month leading up to that moment, there had been a tremendous amount of buildup. And so people were primed to take action and highly emotionally invested in the outcome of the bill. And of course, as things dragged on, we knew that it would have to conclude somehow. It wasn't that the FAB 14, the 14 Democratic senators were going to stay in Illinois forever. There was going to be some kind of outcome or resolution. And I remember that, and I was following it closely because I was doing media work with the TAA and our website and Twitter account, Defend Wisconsin. And I remember that morning that there were some kind of leaked news on Madison.com, the local news website for the local newspapers, that indicated that there were some back dealings that looked like there might be compromise, that perhaps some of the Republicans were talking to some of the Democrats. And so things were looking a little bit like they might be coming to some kind of conclusion. I thought optimistically that perhaps the collective bargaining provisions would be taken out of the bill. I remember that evening, probably about 5:30, I was having dinner with a friend, and we were actually scheduled to go to a TAA executive board meeting that would have started at 6 p.m., and we both got text messages from a friend of ours saying they were going to split the bill, and they were going to vote on the bill. And it was a little confusing at first what that meant exactly. And so I called our friend Abion up and asked him, what's going on? What does this mean? This text message that you just sent? And he explained that they were going to split off, what had kept the Republicans, even though they had a majority in the Senate, from voting was that because there were fiscal provisions in the bill, they needed to have 20 senators present to vote. However, there were only 19 Republicans. So when all of the Senate Democrats fled the state, it deprived the Republicans of the one person necessary for the quorum required to vote on a bill that contained fiscal provisions. And so it is kind of surprising that the Republicans didn't actually pull this move sooner, than they did. But so then what happened was what they ended up doing, rather than working out a compromise that might have been acceptable to the Democrats and to members of the public that were protesting, they simply, all along, Walker and the Republicans had said that the bill was about money, that the state had this tremendous fiscal crisis for the biennium, and that the action was driven by a budget crisis, and that it was about money. But this is when it became extremely apparent, as it, I guess, to most of us already was, but that it wasn't about money, that it was about stripping away fundamental rights to collectively bargain. Because what they ended up doing, even though they had claimed all along it was a fiscal bill, they split off the fiscal provisions, which enabled the Senate, the Republicans alone, to vote without that necessary extra member, one of the Democrats. So they were able to vote on the non-fiscal provisions of the supposedly fiscally driven bill without 20 members present. And so there was a lot of fallout afterwards about, of course, the public notice and whether or not there was adequate amount of public notice for this meeting. But so when we heard, it was probably about 5:30, and they were scheduled to vote at 6 p.m. And I was at the campus end of State Street with a friend, and we immediately gathered up our things and started rushing towards the walking up towards the Capitol. And it's about a mile, between campus and the Capitol. And I remember, and this is early March, the 10th of March, we're walking up State Street, and I remember the mood of the moment. There, as we were getting up towards the Capitol, a couple of bikers biked past us yelling about the bill. They're going to vote on the bill. They're going to vote on the bill. Get to the Capitol. Get to the Capitol. And as we got up to the State Street side of the Capitol, there was a huge, this was early March, so it was lots of snow. There was a huge mound of snow on the intersection, the State Street intersection with the Capitol Square. And there was a guy standing on top of the snow pile. So snow pile is probably definitely taller than I am. So at least maybe 6 or 6.5 feet tall. A guy was standing on top of the snow pile yelling about the bill, kind of like Paul Revere, like a town crier, just yelling, "Get to the Capitol now! Everybody get to the Capitol! They're going to vote on the bill! They're going to vote on the bill!" And it was this terrible but yet amazing moment to see the community and our state and even the nation paying attention, just so engaged. And as I said before, it was in the context of just expectation that something would happen. And also it's important to note that in that last, I want to say week and a half, roughly the last week from when the official occupation ended to this day, the Department of Administration had really clamped down on public access to the Capitol and really restricted access to the Capitol. And so there was only one door of the Capitol open, and it was on the King Street side, so on the opposite side from State Street. So, we had to rush around to the other side, and we got there a little before 6 p.m., and there was a long single file line that went out to the edge of the street on the Capitol Square. So we got in line, and everybody's, emotions are high. We know the people, the hundreds or so of us that are waiting in line, know that the vote's going to happen. But in order to get into the Capitol, we have to wait in line. And it was very orderly. And my friend Jay and I were able to get into the Capitol right a little bit before 6 p.m. when the vote was scheduled to happen. So, we went through the single file line, and then getting in the Capitol, at that point they had metal detectors set up. So we had to go through metal detectors, have a pat down, put all of our things from our pockets into trays and have them examined. So it took time to get into the Capitol, and it was a single file line. There were already, I would say, several hundred or so people inside when we got there. But it wasn't as though you could just walk in. There was that the Department of Administration had been, as I said, limiting access. And that was something also, to get back to what I was talking about a little bit last time, the importance of social media and particularly of Defend Wisconsin, the Twitter account that we've been running that was particularly important in that period when the Department of Administration was limiting access to the Capitol because there was a real dearth of information of, and the Department of Administration officials were always changing what their procedures were, what you could bring into the Capitol, what doors were open, you know, if there was a special door for media or for handicapped individuals, what items were prohibited. So the rules were on a daily basis changing, and there were so many people that were that wanted to get in the Capitol, like, or if you could get a special pass if you were going to go to a legislative aid office. And so our account, Defend Wisconsin, was particularly important in getting information about that out, including on this day. I wasn't in the Capitol before, but one of the other volunteers with the TAA sent out a tweet, you know, saying, I should probably have the text here, actually. I can read it to you. What I would call, on this issue, the most important Twitter message of the year that read, emergency, Republican senators to split budget repair bill and vote on the union killing things tonight, everybody to the Capitol now, and then the hashtag WIUnion. And that was retweeted more than 100 times. So it helps get the message out. And I sent the text message on to a number of people, and so some friends joined me. And that was the only day when things felt particularly tense to me, being outside of that Senate chamber right at 6 p.m. with several hundred other people chanting, shame, shame, you know, as we knew they were voting, and apparently they had allowed a few, like 20 members of the public into the actual chamber to supposedly say that it was open to the public, though there were hundreds of us in the building but outside of the chamber, and knowing that that vote was taking place in spite of all the opposition. And it was an emotional moment, and it was an emotional night to be in the Capitol. But again, I think that what we were able to do collectively as the TAA was very important in helping get out information about what was going on, and being a presence in the Capitol was very important. And of course the Republicans voted. There was one no vote. Dale Schultz did vote no on the bill, but almost unanimously, you know, they passed the bill. It went to the Assembly the next morning, and was very quickly, a few days later, signed by Governor Walker.
Well, thank you for that. I guess I know you have a list there of things. You gave a presentation this summer, and so you sort of, you know, had to sort of put this into words, or at least sort of topics, to be able to get on the record. And as I said, I think you've answered to a certain extent most of the questions that I wanted to ask. Although I think the next question you haven't addressed directly, and that's, do you believe the media, and I guess I would use the term mainstream media, accurately represented the protests?
I was surprised, actually, by the coverage. I've talked to various people that have had difference of opinion from me, and this is completely anecdotal. I haven't analyzed the coverage myself. But I do feel that overall the coverage was relatively positive, more positive than I would have expected. To kind of backtrack to when Governor Walker first announced the bill in mid-February, that first weekend, you know, he made the comments about the National Guard, and that first weekend the coverage was very positive, and towards Governor Walker's position, and framed, it was positive towards his position, and it was framed around the idea of the budget deficit and fiscal crisis. So the message that Governor Walker and the Republicans were trying to put out was was the mainstream media narrative. But then I felt that there was a shift when students, the TAA and undergraduate students, held a march on February 14th, the following Monday. And as I talked about last time, more in detail, you know, using the imagery of hearts and love and talking about education and you know, hands off our teachers, which is the slogan that the undergraduates were putting forth. I think that that really did help start to shift the tone to a more pro-worker perspective. And so on the 15th, the day that there was the public hearing, on above the fold, the front cover picture on the Wisconsin State Journal, one of the major papers in the state, what was a picture of our demonstration and of some of the graduate students holding up our I Heart UW, Walker Don't Break My Heart Valentine's. So I do think that the message shifted quite significantly, you know, in those first days when the mass protests started happening that week. And I think that we were fairly successful at getting our message out as a TAA, because there were a number of us that are communication students that were pushing the organization to think strategically and to be actively trying to frame the message. And because we were situated for the bulk of the protests having a base in the Capitol and a place where reporters were coming. And so I think that helped us, for the small part that we were doing, shift that message and focus on what we saw as the key themes about workers' rights, about democracy, importance of education and public sector, and so on. So I do think that that period then, from our first march until, I feel like, again, you know, Governor Walker, he pushed back his budget address, and he actually held it on, I believe it was March 1st. I think it was after March 1st. I think he was originally supposed to hold it on March 1st, and he ended up holding it later. I would have to go back and check the exact date. But I feel like between mid-February until when he gave his budget address, the coverage was very positive towards the public sector worker protest against the budget repair bill side of things. I feel like Walker got fairly positive coverage then when he gave that budget address. But I think that there overall was a shift that we even are still seeing today, because rather than taking as the kind of standard narrative, media narrative, being pro Walker and kind of the pro business side, but you even now will see things like controversial action, controversial bill inserted when talking about the Republicans and when talking about Walker. So the narrative has shifted. Kind of the standard narrative has shifted somewhat, I guess for lack of a better term, I might say towards the left, but I don't think that it's really a matter of being towards left or right, but towards questioning the anti-democratic moves that the Republicans and Walker have been pushing through. You know, budget repair bill was the first time that we really saw this, but there have been numerous bills that have been passed afterwards. For example, the voter ID bill that has very significantly changed the requirements for voting here in Wisconsin is another one. So I feel like when you see Governor Walker mentioned and you see the Republicans' legislation mentioned, you'll see more of a questioning narrative. So I think overall it's been relatively positive.
Thank you. All right. So as far as my questions about the actual protests themselves. That is all I have. So the questions I have now are sort of post-protest. So I don't know if you want to, at this point, if there's anything else on your mind specifically about the protests, or if we want to wait and sort of maybe try to hit that at the end of this session.
Not at this time, I
okay.
guess.
Okay. All right, so let's move on, and I want to talk about, again, some of the events that have happened. Get your personal take on some events that have happened post-protests. And one sort of, I think, can be tied to the protest, or at least around the same time, and that's the Kloppenburg Supreme Court election. So my specific question to you is, were you involved in that in any way? And whether, if so or if not, what your thoughts were about that election?
I helped a little bit. I phone banked a few times from the TAA office for the Kloppenburg campaign. I had talked last time about how we had run the TAA office, not myself personally, but the organization had run the TAA office as a phone bank center during the protests in February and March, but also continuing through the April spring elections and the Supreme Court election. And so I did do that a few times. I wasn't as active on that campaign, and there were a number of other issues going on in the spring related to the TAA that I was working on, most notably former Chancellor Biddy Martin's proposal for a new Badger partnership that would have split the UW-Madison off from the rest of the UW system and created it as a public authority model. So that was a concurrent issue that was taking a lot of the TAA's attention also in the spring, along with the election.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't have that written down on our first draft of notes. A colleague and I created. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind talking in a bit more detail, because it is an event that happened concurrently to the Capitol protests and could have and still does, I think, affect our campus today. So you want to talk a little bit more about the New Badger Partnership?
Sure. It was a less clear-cut issue. The TAA came out in opposition to the New Badger Partnership, and I think that we struggled, though, with what's the alternative. There's always a tension between promoting your ideals for the sake of something being your ideal, affordable public education, which I believe very strongly, and the TAA does as an organization, hold that as a principle to promote public education at its core. But then on the flip side, struggling with the financial realities of the university system and the cuts to the university that had been announced in the spring, and we've even seen additional cuts be announced in the fall, and the reality of how you deal with those cuts. So on the New Badger Partnership issue, the organization took a stance against it and organized pretty strongly and vocally in opposition to former Chancellor Martin. Though on that issue, there was a lot more contention, I guess I would say, within the organization. It's a complicated issue. You know, I had a radio show last spring and produced a show about New Badger Partnership and read through quite a bit of the material, but still don't even feel like I had the greatest sense of exactly what it would mean. You know, so you can talk about things like flexibilities in purchasing and, you know, the most clear-cut issue being, you know, having separated UW, would have separated UW-Madison off from the rest of the system. So I was personally more mixed about it. And I feel that there were a lot of people in the TAA that were. So that was a little bit harder of an issue to negotiate within the organization. And for me, the issue was, well, what can we present or what can we support as a viable alternative? You know, we feel like we should be calling for the chance, you know, that the chancellor should be calling for restoring funding to the university and increasing student financial aid and protections for student financial aid and all of those things. But again, that tension between financial reality and ideal was hard to negotiate on that issue, because I listened to a number of interviews that Biddy Martin had done on the issue and can really empathize with some of the things that she was saying about the global marketplace for higher education and how we have to compete globally now. But at the same time, I was very strongly opposed to the public authority model part of it and splitting UW-Madison off. But I think some of the other things that were included in the New Badger Partnership and some of the things that did get passed, parts about increasing flexibilities in funding and giving universities in the system block grants as opposed to line items for particular things, are things that I didn't feel that were that alarming, but that's not the position that was held by other people in the TAA. It's a very nuanced issue.
Okay. So as this...
But can I add one thing about that?
Yes.
You know, but on the New Badger partnership issue, I do think as a CAA that even though I had some reservations about our position, I guess I would say, I do think that we took the right position to take a stance against the public authority model. And, you know, we saw over the summer that Biddy Martin did leave the university. And so I think that that what the CAA did in the spring and trying to push against that, against university administration, what was the right thing to do. We organized a forum where Biddy Martin did come, and trying to educate the campus about what it was, a very difficult issue with lots of different facets that was going on simultaneously with all of the collective bargaining. So, you know, we were trying to educate and advocate on that issue. That's all.
Okay. So you mentioned summer. As summer rolled around here in Wisconsin, there were recall elections. Both Republican and Democratic senators had recalls against them. So I guess my general question is, how'd you spend your summer? But the sort of subtext is, were you involved in the recalls?
You know, I was not actively involved in the recalls for the senators. I did do some work with Defend Wisconsin, with the website, during Walkerville, in leading up. I was pretty involved up until the budget, until the state budget was passed in June. But quite frankly, I had to spend time on schoolwork. You know, I had to get caught up on other things, and so I didn't spend a lot of time personally on the recall issue. I followed it. And, you know, well, it was very encouraging that the Democrats won back two seats, you know, not the necessary three that would have swung the Senate to the Democratic position. And so I can't speak from personal involvement on that issue. I have been a little more involved with the Walker recall. One of the things that has been hard as this issue is dragged on is, what do you do simply as an organization and as a union to maintain the TAA, to maintain the union itself, versus the political activities that in the long run might get the bill overturned? Will get the bill overturned in the long run, the political process aspects, the recalls, versus signing up new members. So, for example, I was active in the summer with things like preparing for, you know, making a decision about whether or not the TAA was going to try to seek recertification under Wisconsin Act 10. And we ended up deciding not to seek recertification under Wisconsin Act 10 because we feel that it was an unjust standard, and that what we would have gained by seeking recertification, which would have been a very narrow ability to bargain solely on wages, I guess frankly wouldn't have been worth it. And so that was a decision that the TAA made in August. And then fall, you know, there's a lot of turnover every year with new graduate assistants coming to campus, TAs, PAs, and even RAs, which hadn't been covered by our contract in the past. So there's a big orientation membership push that's in the end of August, beginning of September. So there are all of those kinds of things that, well, a membership drive would have gone on anyway, an orientation drive would have gone on anyway, but there was an extra added element of needing to not only try to sign up new members, but also re-sign up old members, because everybody had to sign up again because our dues are not taken out of payroll automatically anymore, and there's no fair share, which is something that if you were covered by the contract, you paid what was called fair share, which was the equivalent of union dues. But the idea being that everybody benefits from the work of the union, and so even if you choose not to join, which is completely somebody's right, you should pay towards services that you get from the union. So Wisconsin Act 10 got rid of fair share, and it also got rid of payroll deductions. So we had to sign up every single member over again in addition to try to sign up new members. And so there was a tremendous amount of effort that went into that process in the summer and going into the fall. So the time that I spent on TA activities in the summer and mostly into the fall have been more on those things, though I did help with collecting petition signatures for the Walker recall about 2 weeks ago now when the drive first kicked off.
So there is a question here that you sort of alluded to in your answer about the summer recalls, and that is how did you budget your time during the protests? And I think that can now be sort of moved through because, you know, just because the protests ended doesn't mean it sounds like your involvement in the political process or the TAA process has. So how do you budget your time between being a student, being a TA, and being an activist?
I have found that difficult to do, and I do think that most people find that difficult. I have been spending less time personally on TA activities starting this fall. You know, I felt that it was important to continue being very active through the membership drive in September, and then the last couple of months I've been trying to spend less time on TA activities so that I can refocus on my own research and my coursework and my job on campus. I'm actually a research assistant in my department, so I'm not TAing this year, but I'm working for my department, and so trying to spend the majority of my time on those other priorities. I plan to take my preliminary exams in the spring, so I found that I needed to rebalance a little bit. And that's a difficult thing to do because everything that we do in the TAA is very important, particularly now. But at the same time, you know, I came here to get a degree. You know, I came back to school because I wanted to get a PhD, and in the long run, I would like to teach. And so finding that balance is challenging because graduate school is all-encompassing. Research is all-encompassing, and teaching is critical, and the work I do in my department is very important to me. But at the same time, so is what we're doing in the TAA. So I tried to stay involved with the TAA a little bit, like helping with collecting recall petition signatures and doing some press releases and continuing to do some media work. But I've also, in the last couple months, been trying to hand off some of what had been my responsibilities in the TAA to other individuals.
So I think the last thing I want to ask before we sort of get your final thoughts, or not sort of get your final thoughts, is the Occupy movement. I'm wondering how if you have followed that, and if you have, do you see any correlation between what people are trying to do throughout the country and the world to a certain extent, and what happened here in Madison in February and March?
I have been following it. I'm actually doing some research this semester on the Occupy Wall Street movement. So I've been following it relatively closely over the last couple of months. And it's been interesting to see that movement progress. And I do think there are some parallels, but that we need to be careful about drawing parallels. Within the Occupy Wall Street movement and reading their literature, they, you know, are presenting a public face of creating an image of moral authority, and that's kind of pulling on previous struggles, Arab Spring being one that they mention, as well as Wisconsin. There's actually an Occupied Wall Street Journal newspaper that some of the activists in New York produced. I think that they've produced 3 issues now. And in the first 2, they have a timeline that runs along the bottom, and it mentions the events of Arab Spring, and it mentions Wisconsin, and there were also anti-austerity protests in Britain and Greece in the spring and in the summer. And so this kind of drawing connections between various strands of a global movement. But at the same time, I think that there are important differences too. when you talk about Wisconsin, you talk about our livelihoods, you know, that impact. And I don't mean to say that talking about Occupy Wall Street isn't talking about people's livelihoods, because it definitely is. But perhaps it's not quite as uniform. You know, in Wisconsin, you had all public sector workers are affected by the provisions of budget repair bill, both the financial provisions and also the collective bargaining provisions. And there was a very clear target. You know, Scott Walker and the Republicans, there was a clear unifying issue. Perhaps this is more a way that I would draw out the differences between Occupy Wall Street and Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, you had a relatively short time frame, a clear issue, a clear target to mobilize against, being Walker and the Republicans, and you know, stakes that were somewhat high. I mean, Walker could have, you know, if we would have decided to go on strike, for example, Walker could have fired everyone. It is illegal to strike, you know, as a teaching assistant, we can't go on strike. But that is something that that we did discuss as one potential tactic, ultimately deciding not to do that, but it was something that was under discussion amongst other tactics. And so those stakes, I think, are very concrete. You know, when you're considering whether or not you might take a job action that could ultimately potentially get you fired versus Occupy Wall Street, I think it's more diffuse and more perhaps of a, like a lifestyle protest perhaps, or there are elements of Occupy Wall Street that it's kind of activism as a lifestyle. And I don't mean that in a negative sense at all, but that there's a culture around Occupy Wall Street that is very distinct. It's in and of itself, it's drawing on anarchist subcultures, and it's drawing on what had been pre-existing subculture movements that sparked, in a sense, and caught the attention now. But things like General Assemblies, consensus, modified consensus decision making aren't things that are new. You know, participatory democracy dates back to the civil rights movement. You know, that idea of collective decision making, and who knows, potentially before, but you know, dating back at least to SNCC and the civil rights movement. But there's something that about Occupy Wall Street that is very important, and it captured this collective imagination right now in the economic recession in which we find ourselves, and the global austerity, you know, austerity pressures going on in countries around the world, and that there are connections between those. But I hope that you can see I'm getting at some of the differences between mm-hmm. what the stakes are.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, thank you for that. So my final question is to put the ball in your court and to ask if there's anything. You know, whether it's a strong memory, positively or negatively, some things that you've written down that you feel it important to get off your chest, so to speak, and on the record. So any final comments about either the February, March protests themselves or the aftermath?
Well, that's a very broad question, and we've covered a lot.
As you're looking through that, maybe you sort of asked, you answered one of my questions about sort of your future plans academically. A sub question of that is, has this and your previous involvement led you to think that there's going to be some future political activity for you, not necessarily, you know, running for office, but continuing to be involved in the process in some way? And if so, how do you see yourself being involved in the process?
Yeah, definitely. I do think so. I'm not sure in exactly what capacity. Right now, as I mentioned already, I'm trying to focus on academics and on my research, which unfortunately doesn't leave a whole lot of time in a day for activism. But I have found what we have been able to do this year to be one of the most gratifying and important things I've ever been a part of in my life, and that definitely the movement needs to go on. And that I had a moment a few weeks ago after I on the 15th, which was the first day that we could collect Walker, collect petition signatures for Walker's recall, and I had volunteered with the TAA. We had a booth at Union South near here, and the enthusiastic response was overwhelming. I mean, it was the first day, and I assumed there are a lot of people in Wisconsin that would like to recall Scott Walker, but I was still overwhelmed by the amount of the response. We were collecting petition signatures at a rate, when you combine Walker and the lieutenant governor, of about 100 an hour. You know, people that were, you know, from undergraduate students to people that were just visiting campus, you know, all range of ages were coming up and like, is this where I can sign? And there was energy around that day that I hadn't felt since the height of the protests. And so it was good to feel that that movement is continuing. And I want to be part of that. So, you know, I do plan to help out a little bit more with the recall effort. But I think over the long term, it's important to remember that the political process and voting in particular and being part of the democratic process is very important. But it's also not the be-all and end-all of activism, that there are many other things that we need to do both in our daily lives and also in a more systematic way that can make the world a better place. And that the political process is only one piece of that. So I don't know that I'm really answering your question about what I plan to do, because mm-hmm. I don't have a concrete plan other than to say that, yes, I would like to, I plan to be politically active in the future on these types of whether human rights and workers' rights and democratic mm-hmm. process issues.
Okay. So I'll slightly rephrase the last question to end this, and that would be, you've already mentioned several things that I think would be considered sort of key moments, or at least key memories. You just mentioned, you know, we talked for almost 15 minutes, I think, about the day the Senate stripped the fiscal part of the bill and passed the bill. And you talked about some other things in the last interview. So are there other, when you think about the Capitol protest 2011 and you figure this out in your mind, are there other events that stand out for you? And again, they don't necessarily have to be events that fit on the timeline, but they might be, you know, a moment with somebody or an event that you happen to see in the Capitol that really stood out.
I think more about the people. You know, I worked alongside old friends, you know, people that are in my program or that I had previously known through the TAA or otherwise, and also met so many more people, and that making those connections and, you know, just exchanging phone numbers with somebody and then, you know, exchanging text messages and just how, you know, kind of seeing network activism in practice. And I think activism is always networked, you know, and the way that social networks synergize around activism in a crisis moment like that. What was something that really struck me, because those are questions and things that I think about academically in my own research, and so to be able to be part of this, you know, has been very insightful in how I think about my own research as well. Aside from personally, you know, feeling invested in the issue, and so I think that that's probably a key thing. I'll give you an example, perhaps a concrete example to finish. So there was one day I was walking by the food table outside of that room 300 Northeast where the TAA was coordinating out of, and I ran into a guy that I had had class with probably three semesters prior, and we're like, oh, hey, oh yeah, we had class together, and he's a graduate student in the School of Education. And he came up to me later and was like, your website sucks, defendwisconsin.org. And I can help make the website better. And I said, okay, sure, do it. And so he and a couple other individuals from the School of Education then stayed up the entire night and redesigned the defendwisconsin.org website. You know, and so that was the connection that just happened. Like, I happened to have had class with him, we ran into each other, and he helped out. You know, just that synergy of energy in that space was quite amazing. Probably another thing that stands out is that, you know, when the Department of Administration was limiting access to the Capitol, and there was very limited internet access in the Capitol, we actually had a number of Defend Wisconsin TAA meetings in my apartment. I used to live three blocks from the Capitol, and so I was having the publicity media team of the TAA over to my apartment, and we had several rather packed meetings with like 10 people trying to sit anywhere they could in my apartment, and just to have a space that was close to the Capitol to use the internet. Just happened to be my apartment. You know, so just like using every single resource that we have, whether it's text messaging, what, you know, human resources and technological resources to get out the message and to help support the activism and organizing. So I guess those are the things that stand out, that really it's about the people and the creativity that we were all able to bring to what we were doing, and the passion that we were able to bring to what we were doing.
Great. Well, Jill, thank you very much. I think that's a good place to end. So this concludes the interview with Jill Hopke for our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project.